case number 09-1296. Maryland Public Service Commission et al. Petitioners versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Mr. Speck for petitioners, Ms. Banta for respondent, Mr. Flynn for intervener, PJM Interconnection LLC, Mr. Estes for interveners, PJM Power Providers Group et al.
They're working on it.
That's why they're highly regulated.
Yes.
They're not weird.
All these matters of great Southern DC are high good tax lawyers.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Randall Speck, and I represent the Maryland Public Service Commission and the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal, please. Right now, customers in PJM service area are being charged and are being required to pay billions of dollars more for capacity because FERC's experimental RPM mechanism turned out to be badly flawed, as it was applied to this four-year transitional period at the beginning of the RPM mechanism. Those customers couldn't object to this application at the beginning or before the auctions were conducted because at that point they didn't have any evidence, and FERC is entitled to the benefit of the doubt for its adoption of an experimental
process. They could have objected to the process, right? They could have said that the anticipated mitigation procedures are going to be inadequate or something of that nature.
Yes, Your Honor, we could have objected at that point.
Why?
But we didn't have any evidence at that point.
So at that point, it's hard. It could work out.
In fact, some of those objections were made in comments that were made to FERC on the settlement agreement. But at that point, we had no evidence. And FERC said, well, if you want to object later,
procedures were intended to address the concerns that would come from lack of competition suppliers, right? I mean, they provided that the suppliers can't withhold supply, price was capped for sellers with market power. So that, I mean,
there's no question, Your Honor, that they were intended to serve precisely that mitigation function. Because particularly during the transition period, there was no opportunity for new suppliers to come in and to provide the cap on the competitive price.
Well, that's why didn't the mitigation procedures supply a cap?
They were supposed to do that, Your Honor. But our argument is that those mitigation procedures that were specified in the tariff were inadequate to do that, as proven by the fact during the transition period, the prices varied all over the lot. And at some points, in the same capacity zone and with the same capacity suppliers, existing capacity suppliers, you had a very high price in one auction, a very low price in the next auction, a very high price in the next auction.
Let me understand your catch-22 argument. You certainly had access to experts to talk about the model that was coming out of the settlement agreement.
Yes, Your Honor.
And as I recall, there were serious objections raised, and the commission took the position that it wasn't perfect, but it was good enough.
And the commission specifically said, come back to us if you think it's not adequate.
That's right. All right, so the commission says what they meant by that is, if it doesn't work out, come back and we'll change it for the future. But everybody was on notice of what this settlement agreement proposed. Experts were available to talk about a lot of different things. And certainly, petitioners and others knew that there was a capacity problem, certainly in certain parts of the service areas, so that there wasn't going to be enough time, probably, for all this new generation to come online in time. at least for the earliest auctions. So all that was information that was available and presumably that the commission was aware of, and nevertheless it approved this.
Yes, Your Honor, and the problem was they approved it based on their assumptions about what was going to happen. Everybody assumed that the prices would be much lower. In fact, the commission specified, said in its order, that we don't expect these mitigation provisions to actually even be implemented because we think that the price is going to be relatively low during this time period in the
All
transition
right.
auctions.
So, I mean, obviously I'm not an expert in this area, but when I look at some of these reports, they do note, like the Brattle report, the high prices in the early auctions, but they say, you know, the system achieved its purpose in terms of generating new capacity so that there would be reliability of service.
Well, during the transition period, Your Honor, there really wasn't any new capacity that came in to speak
That's
of.
Right, but over the period of this four-year transition, accomplished what was supposed to be done by this?
Well, one of the arguments that is made is that it provided price signals
yep.
during this time period, that these areas were short of capacity and therefore needed more new capacity.
Right.
But, of course, during the transition period, there was nothing that could be done about that. The new capacity required probably a three-year lead time.
Well, that's the nature of a transition, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but
there's a sense that during the transition it isn't going to be perfect or close to it. So but we're going to try and put procedures in place that will get it as good as it can get.
But if you find out during the transition from the experience that you achieve that in fact it's not doing what you expected it to do, and in fact customers are paying far more than they should pay, even during a transition period, then customers ought to have an opportunity at that point to object. All we're asking, Your Honor, is not that the commission revamp the entire transition period. We're asking them to look at the evidence of what happened during the transition period and determine whether the results of those transition auctions matched their intentions.
Now, you say consistently that the FERC focuses on the process and not the results. I mean, that's my word.
Yes, Your Honor.
But in the red brief at 37, they say all supply offers were mitigated to a competitive level, and there was no evidence that suppliers exercised market power.
Well, if you look at those citations carefully, Your Honor, you'll see that in every instance, when they say they were mitigated to competitive levels, what they mean is they were mitigated to the tariff specified levels. The market monitor in PJM really doesn't have authority to do anything other than to mitigate offers to the tariff specified levels. In fact, FERC has been very careful to limit the discretion of the market monitor under those circumstances.
Okay.
So all that they're saying by that is the PJM and the suppliers followed the tariff. And what we're saying is the tariff was wrong. The tariff produced an inadequate result, a result that is unjust and unreasonable.
Okay, so on rehearing, FERC says, in response to these very arguments, we've heard you. We've reviewed the evidence, and we do not find that the rates during this transition period were unjust and unreasonable.
Well, Your Honor, we would submit that they didn't actually look at or at least acknowledge the evidence that was in the record. And we provided two what we believe are very important examples of mitigation, the evidence from the first four auctions that indicates the mitigation was not working as was intended, because you had, with the same group of existing suppliers, you had some bidding in one auction at a very high price, low price in the next auction, very high price in the next auction. All of those could not have been at their marginal cost or their avoidable cost. Something was going on there, and the Commission, we gave some explanations. We believe it was the exercise of market power. And that's because the tariff levels were set at such a high level that it wasn't going to constrain those suppliers' offers at all. Mm-hmm. In fact, the only time they got any constraint on their offers was in the fifth auction, and then you got a much lower price.
So let me just be clear. Why wouldn't you have known that at the beginning, that the tariff caps were just set too high, that it gave too much maneuverability to existing capacity sellers?
We just didn't have the evidence at that point, Your Honor. I mean, we didn't.
And as a model, you couldn't critique it on that ground?
It really wasn't possible at that point, Your Honor. For instance, there were, this is a very complex process, as you can imagine. And FERC acknowledged that it's hard to define exactly what the cost ought to be, what that mitigated cost ought to be. And so it's very difficult to say in the abstract, here's where it ought to be, and before you have any evidence to say to FERC, it ought to be lower than that. And there were even some specific adders that were included in the first four auctions, and it was difficult to say how those were going to apply. It applied only to some generators, not to all generators. But when the evidence started rolling in, and it really wasn't clear until after the fifth auction, when you had competition from new suppliers, but the evidence began to come in, and it was quite clear that those mitigated levels were not doing what the Commission had intended them to do. They were not constraining of the exercise of market power.
So when you filed your complaint with the RTO after the first auction, you were just focused on the results there?
No, Your Honor. We only filed the one complaint, and it was after the fifth auction.
You didn't do it after the first?
No, Your Honor. Right. That was inadequate information at that point, and we had to, what we were looking for was a comparison over time as to how these mitigated levels for offers were working.
So to the extent the responses are, well, FERC found there was reliance and you haven't shown that no seller did not rely, sort of the double negative.
Right.
And your proposal, since you have this two-pronged burden, FERC has found that's not just and reasonable. Therefore, it was acted properly in dismissing your complaint. And your response, as I understand it in part, is Section 206, plain language, talks about charges. Second, you want some sort of technical conference review for FERC to come to grips with this expert evidence that you've offered?
No, Your Honor. What we've suggested is that if, in what we believe is a very unlikely event, that any of the suppliers could show that they actually relied mm-hmm. on the auction rates, mm-hmm. if that were ever the case, that there should be an exception, in essence, that permits them to recover their reliance costs. We're not suggesting
it's unfair to treat, you know, those who could show it differently from those who couldn't show it. I mean, I just need to understand sort of what the process is here, that if the agency isn't persuaded by your alternative, then do you necessarily automatically lose?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because, of course, during the initial proposal of this RPM process, PJM came in with a 206 filing and said that the existing reliability mechanism was not working and was unjust and unreasonable, and they proposed an RPM type procedure. Mm-hmm. FERC said, no, that's not a just and reasonable process, but we're going to hold a paper hearing in order to determine what the just and reasonable process is.
Well, that's what you want?
Something like that, Your Honor. And the reason, I think, is fairly apparent from the structure of Section 206. It certainly wouldn't be reasonable for FERC to determine, in this instance, for instance, that the RPM mechanism during the transition period is unjust and unreasonable. But because you haven't offered a just and reasonable alternative, we're going to let that unjust and reasonable process continue. And we're going to let all of those charges be made to customers, even though we know they're unjust and unreasonable. Certainly, at that point, FERC is obligated to find out what would be just and reasonable and to put that in its place.
Why don't we hear from the other parties, and then we'll give you some time on rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Hi. Hello.
Good morning.
Would you remind me how the three parties are splitting their time in terms of issues to be argued?
I don't believe we've split the issues.
I thought your motion made that argument. Any rate, proceed. I don't want to take
it. One of the interveners put in the motion. We just agreed.
All right.
We take 14, give 3 and 3.
All right. Fine.
Ideally, I cover everything, and no one has anything they need to do. But it never works that way. Good morning. I'm Carol Banta for the commission. To begin with a couple of points about the mitigation, because I know that's a key point. Petitioner suggested that the commission didn't really expect mitigation to come into play. And if you look at paragraph 101 of what we called the reliability settlement order, I think that's the December 2006 order that approved the tariff. The commission always anticipated that mitigation could come into play in constrained areas, and especially in the early transitional auctions when there wouldn't be much new capacity yet. So that was not a surprise. And the mitigation procedures that were followed here were fully litigated, and many of these issues were considered in those orders.
The point is, despite your best intentions, they didn't work. And the evidence of that is pretty striking, right? Before, you have certain prices before RPM, you have certain prices that come out of the first full-term auction, and then you've got these outliers in the transitional auctions. They don't look anything like the others. Why isn't that compelling evidence that something went wrong? Particularly because the measure ought to be the first full-term auction, right? I mean, that's where we're getting to. That's the promised land of deregulation. And so that's what it's supposed to look like. And the transitional auction doesn't look anything like it.
Well, first of all, I don't think the transitional auctions were expected to look like that, because we're relying on existing generation. And also, going back to paragraph 101 that I mentioned, the commission understood that mitigation would apply to existing generation. But I would point to where the commission in the orders at issue here, for instance, in paragraph, I think it's 20 through, no.
What are you looking at now? I'm sorry.
I'm getting myself lost.
Okay, sorry.
In the first order, it's paragraph 30, where the commission pointed out that every offer was mitigated, subject to the mitigation caps. The market monitor specifically looked at every megawatt of power in the PJM footprint and made sure there was no physical withholding. And then as far as economic withholding, which is the other allegation, if you look at JA 404, that paragraph continuing there, the market monitor had reviewed the offers and found that they were within avoidable costs. The petitioner's quibble is with what is allowed to be in avoidable costs.
No, and their quibble, as I understand it, is that the market monitor was simply authorized to look at whether or not the sellers were complying with the tariff. He found that as to every objection raised, they complied with the tariff. And FERC says, you know, no tariff violations, end of discussion. And the thing I'm trying to understand is this catch-22 argument, that before the auctions, you have this settlement agreement in the models, and you don't have evidence to suggest to the petitioners don't have evidence to suggest to FERC that there are going to be problems. So then they experience this, and they see the transition period compared to the first term auction, and now they've got the evidence, and the commission says too late.
No, the commission didn't say too late.
They said too late because we can't do anything about it, because all these different reasons they raised, file rate doctrine.
No, but the commission did not, and the commission did not say it wouldn't hear this, that it was a collateral attack. The commission did say we won't relitigate the policy determinations that we made in our earlier orders.
But this evidence, we're not convinced that these options should be redone.
And I can walk you through why. If you start with paragraph 30.
Right, but what I don't see, these are very short orders for FERC, as a practical matter. And there's a couple of key paragraphs, and that's it.
But there's a lot packed into those paragraphs that I
we've reviewed the evidence.
No, I know.
I mean, there's a lot packed in that phrase, but it doesn't tell us very much.
Well, if I can just roadmap what the commission was pointing to in paragraph 30 when it quotes Dr. Bowring, the market monitor.
And this is in the original order or the rehearing?
In the first order. Oh, we cite it again in the rehearing order at paragraph 41. But
what paragraph are you in the order?
In the complaint order, I'm in paragraph 30, and in the rehearing order, I'm in paragraph 41. And we get to the same place in both, but I start with paragraph 30 in the complaint order, where the commission is quoting the market monitor and his findings. And in the footnotes, you see we quote paragraphs 11, 12, 13, which takes us in the JA to JA 268, 269, 270. And you look what he's saying about.
I totally agree. The commission cites the market monitor's reports time and again. But the criticism of the market monitor's reports are not that he didn't do his job.
Oh, I know.
But that he had limited responsibilities.
Well, but if we look at, this is where I'm going with this. When you look at the Bowring declaration or affidavit,
right.
He's directly
the market monitor.
He is. And he is directly responding to these very criticisms by Wilson, citing to paragraphs, like paragraph 86, the 80s and 90s, that section of the Wilson affidavit.
His response is, you know, I checked everything and they conform to the tariff.
But what he says is that what explains what appeared to be, what was an increase in the price in, for instance,
appeared
when he's focusing.
Say appeared to be an increase.
I'm sorry. Well, what appeared, I was going a different direction with what it appeared to be, which the commission found to be speculative. But if you look at what happened with the prices in the 2009-2010 auction, for example, and I do want to make the point, because it can be confusing in the briefs, that while these auctions took place 3 months apart, they were for delivery years. And so when we say, when petitioner says something was offered at a certain price and 3 months later it was a totally different price,
no,
it was.
I understand. They were stuck for a year.
Right, but it wasn't that the price changed in those 3 months. It was that the projected price for that year. And what the market monitor explains in direct response to Mr. Bowring with regard to the 2009-2010, there were two things that affected that. One is the CETO, CETL, the transport limits changed and made it a constrained area. That was one effect on prices, a very serious effect on prices in the SWMAAC. That's the area that contains Maryland.
And so you're referring now to which footnote?
To which?
Where I get all this?
Well, this starts with paragraph 11 at JA 268, paragraph 11 in Bowring's affidavit, which is exactly what the commission cites in paragraph 30. So that's how we get here.
Right.
And as you read through 11 and 12 and 13, he's responding very directly to Dr. Wilson's identification of this price spike in 09-10 delivery year. And it's the transmission limits, and it's also the existing generation in Maryland or in that region responding to emissions upgrades, some that were required.
Right. New Jersey kept certain capacity off.
Right. Well, the tariff always included in the mitigation, in the what are your avoidable costs for when we cap your offer. It always included, and this was litigated in the earlier orders, whether it was fair to include that, and the commission said it was.
Fair to include what?
The APIR, as it was called, the Project Investment Recovery. So petitioner now is saying, well, these weren't really avoidable costs because this is capital recovery, and when is that an avoidable cost? And the commission says, well, in this case, we always said it would be, and if you look in the reliability rehearing order, paragraph 150. This is the June 2007 order on rehearing in approving the tariff. Paragraph 150, at the end of that, the commission had just gone through these various adders, such as the investment recovery, to keep existing generation in the market and make necessary upgrades and emission upgrades. And said mitigation does not and should not protect customers from actual capacity cost increases that may be attributed to environmental requirements or other necessary investments in order to allow that generator to participate in the capacity market.
So we would have to find that when the commission approved the settlement, it anticipated that there might be $12 billion in overcharges?
No.
That's what I want to see the commission telling me, that in fact, the $12 billion figure is just a figment of the petitioner's imagination, as it were.
No, the commission says they're not overcharges.
The charts we keep seeing.
Well, because those were the most constrained areas. When the whole reason for a reliability market, what was happening before with the deficiency charges, wasn't working. And Delaware and Maryland, which are New Jersey and Maryland were among the areas that were looking at serious reliability violations coming up.
District of Columbia.
Yes, and facing transmission constraints as well.
Right, so, and the Brattle report points all this out. All right? I mean, so it's not that it's either, you know, it's a neutral witness, as it were, is pointing all this out, that things look skewed. And yet when you go back and look at the commission's original order, it said they didn't anticipate this. So I guess my question is, what kind of evidence must the commission have for it to look at a tariff that's based on modeling without any empirical evidence, where it's got a new scheme? And the commission's basically saying in traditional language, we're just not going to look at this. You know, you can say you had $12 billion in overcharges. You can say that you have experts who say that there were these odd results.
Well, again, all the experts, all the evidence that the petitioners put in was that the prices went up in a given delivery year auction. And when the market monitor looked at it, it was because of costs of existing generation being kept in the capacity market, taking an addition to or a component in their defined avoidable cost that they were always expected to have. But and of course it's the locational.
The commission said it didn't anticipate there were going to be these spikes and things.
Well, it didn't anticipate spikes. It anticipated that the avoidable costs could include these APIR. Or I hate to use the acronym, but the project investment costs. And that, together with transmission constraints, which had been happening and were known to be a problem, were what caused that spike. So the commission said it's not just, wow, these dollars look high, because they do. What made them high was it something that was anticipated and provided for. And again, these happen locationally because the transitional auctions had locational markets for the very price signaling and reliability market considerations that have been used before, not just in PJM, but in one of the other RTOs as well. So it wasn't an anticipated. I think to answer what the commission would need to see to find to grant the complaint, I think you could see, well, first of all, if we didn't have a situation where the market monitor had checked for any physical withholding and had then capped every bid. If we had any unmitigated bids, where certainly there could be market behavior going on, that would be one place to look. If there were some reason to think there were sham transactions to fool the market monitor, it's hard to say. But here it was just, oh, the prices went up. And when the market monitor explained why the capped avoidable costs that he applied to every single offer still allowed for some variation, it was due to these project investments. And as you've mentioned, the Brattle report, one thing the Brattle report found, in particular at paragraph 17 and 18, was that a substantial amount of existing generation stayed in the market that would otherwise have retired, and that there was a net decrease in exports. So there is actually evidence that the commission pointed to that the existing generation stayed in the market for these four auctions until we did have new capacity that was.
So is your reading of the record and the commission's understanding that there was not a $12 billion increase?
I don't know the exact dollar, but I know that the commission looked at it and said that that there was nothing in the way that the mitigation procedures operated and had been anticipated to operate, that we could find this to be unjust and unreasonable.
I understand why it makes a difference whether they say $12 billion as opposed to $1 million.
I do, but I mean, the commission didn't focus on it in terms of dollars because all
it didn't.
But it understood.
In other words, if you have a model where you anticipate there may be some overcharges, you know, I mean, the rates may go up, say $1 million.
Well, that isn't
like
the same as overcharge.
I would correct myself. I don't mean overcharge in the sense it was an unlawful charge.
Right.
But over a charge over the pre-existing rates. All right. And the commission says, well, we anticipate given capacity constraints, et cetera, and we have this monitor who's going to check. And so rates may go up. You know, we don't expect any large shifts.
But then,
you know, this is my hypothetical. $1 million, $2 million, $5 million, $10 million. All right? Now they're claiming $12 billion.
And I'd have to look at what their baseline for the $12 billion is.
I understand. But my point is, I kept looking for the commission to tell me somewhere that this was just off the wall.
And I think that's...
Yeah, and they don't ever say that.
And that just may not be the way they... If the commission always started with the dollar figure that someone... I guess that's just not the way they analyze every opinion. But they looked at what happened in the markets. And also, those prices did come down to the extent... I know the petitioners dismissed the idea of price signaling, but these were the most troublesome markets, reliability-wise. And they did experience spikes, and they had transmission problems. But at the end... once we got to where new capacity had come into the market and new transmission and other things, the price spike went away.
I know, but the petitioner's argument, as I understand it, is the cost greatly exceeded any benefit. If people are going to have to pay such high prices, they'll tolerate a little less reliability.
Well, I would point out, and I don't know if I have it flagged, but there's a specific response to New Jersey in the reliability rehearing order where the commission said, I think paragraph 192 in the reliability rehearing order, and again, that's June 2007 because I know it's confusing. The actual price effects will depend on market conditions. It may be that for some period of time, capacity prices in areas with reliability problems and less cost-effective generation, such as New Jersey, will be higher than in areas with a surfeit of capacity.
This is paragraph 207?
No, I'm sorry, paragraph 192 in the June 2007 order from the tariff proceeding, not from...
Do I have it in the joint appendix?
You do not. We just cited it as authority because I...
No. I mean, how am I supposed to understand this case? If people are citing things that I don't have in the record.
At any rate,
what is it specifically you are citing?
I am specifically saying paragraph 192 of 119 FERC, paragraph 61318.
119 FERC.
61318. In the future, I'll include these in the JA. We had only cited it like we would cite a court case, but we'll provide it in the future.
Well, if it's key to your case.
Yeah.
61 what?
61318.
Thank you.
It was in the series of orders affirmed in the PSEG case.
Okay.
Paragraph 192.
Thank you.
I won't repeat, but the commission said...
expect some increases in New Jersey.
And there's more. Such higher prices reflect the scarcity of capacity in those areas and will provide an incentive for the entry. But going to the point Your Honor had just made, I flip over to the next page, but that may just may be the way my copy is. Still paragraph 192. Even if capacity prices may increase in capacity-constrained areas, those areas will benefit in the long run from increased entry, transmission construction, and demand response. I should mention demand response went up significantly, too. The Brower Report found that. So to the extent that we're talking about short-run costs versus long-term benefits, the commission grappled with that from the start. And knew that these areas could experience some price spikes in a locational transitional market. But in the end, it did bring prices down, and there is more capacity to address reliability concerns.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, Paul Flynn for PJM Interconnection. If I may, let me just explain how the market monitor works and what happened here, because I think there's a misconception about the fact that the market monitor simply said, oh, you complied with the tariff.
So you think that Mr. Wilson or Dr. Wilson's response to the monitor's report is just based on an erroneous premise?
I think most of what you get from Wilson's affidavit, both his original and second affidavits, is really a disagreement on policy grounds about what the rule should be, and a disagreement about, no one disagrees that the measure of a competitive market outcome here in this particular circumstance, and this follows Blumenthal, is a mitigated rate. And so we also agree that if you're going to decide whether or not you're going to commit capacity for a year, and if you're the marginal resource, then what matters is what costs will you avoid in order to not commit as a capacity resource, mm-hmm. and that's your avoidable cost. Mm-hmm. And so what all this argument is about back and forth between these experts is really the policy call on what the rules should be about what's proper avoidable cost, which is something that FERC addressed at length in the prior orders when it approved RPM. So then when you get to what I see FERC doing here is they look at these contentions about these specific price changes in these constrained areas. And they say, well, the complainants are inferring, suggesting that because of the nature of the policy calls made in the rules, that there was the potential or the incentive for people to exercise market power. And they say, but then we look at what the market monitor found when he actually looked at the offers that were submitted. And he found that there were other perfectly valid reasons for why they submitted that the offers that they did. And it isn't simply that they followed the rules. For example, on this issue of withholding, he has to look at whether or not you change the amount of capacity that you rate your unit at. So, for example, one way to reduce the amount of capacity that's being offered into the auction, which is one of the things that affects this auction outcome, mm-hmm. is to change your installed capacity rating. Mm-hmm. And that's a physically determinable fact. And so they provide that information. He looks at it. He says it's okay.
So when the commission approved the settlement and it said it didn't anticipate these price spikes, it was just wrong?
Well, I think there's a little bit of an overcharacterization there of exactly what the commission was anticipating. I mean, the commission, and also as to this business of the overcharge, I think the overcharge, the $12 billion that they're talking about, is relative to their proposed remedy, which FERC did reject as being unreasonable. And so the $12 billion is really not a valid number. It's a number that they concocted based on their alternative view of what they think capacity prices should have been, not based on anybody's sell offers, but simply based on picking a number here in 2007, here in 2010, and interpolating.
Look at the first term auction. Look at what happened there. Extrapolate from that.
Well, actually what they do is they look at the unconstrained part of the PJM region where prices were lower in that first year. They ignore the places where capacity was constrained and prices were higher. They say take that unconstrained price and then in the fourth or fifth auction, pick a point on the curve that feels good to them, $100 a megawatt. It wasn't based on anybody's sell offer. It was just based on a number that they picked, and then they interpolated that, came up with numbers in between those for each of those 3 years, and said, okay, the difference is $12 billion.
I guess I'm still at the first step, not the second.
Okay.
And I want to understand what FERC's response is to their evidence. And that's why I asked you,
well, again,
is it the monitor's position and your position that Mr. Wilson's analysis is just based on a false premise?
Yes, absolutely, it is. And again, the difference is a policy difference on what the rule should be. For example, on this business of the project investment, he simply disagrees that there should that an avoidable cost for a unit that you want to keep for capacity that has to be in place for that year includes additional money that they need to spend. Say, for example, to satisfy environmental regulations, let's say it's an old plant that would retire otherwise. And in order to actually commit as capacity, it's got to spend some money. It's got to have an investment. And FERC actually addressed that in some detail in the underlying orders, and they just didn't like the rule. And so he says, no, because you included this capital investment as an adder to your avoidable cost, which we would say is an appropriate component of avoidable cost, you're somehow above a competitive rate. But he's simply disagreeing about what the definition of a competitive rate is and what a proper avoidable cost is. This was all apparent, by the way, and all discussed in the settlement orders. And if you look at the answer the PJM filed in this case, we walk through and compare all the arguments that the complainants were making in the current case with all the
arguments,
policy levels that were being made, and that's at JA 233 to 243. And so it really is, I mean, FERC is looking at this and they're saying, look, these guys aren't really talking about what specifically happened here. They're talking about the rules, and they don't like the rules over and over and over again. And these rules allow you.
Let me just be clear.
Sure.
Where I asked petitioner's counsel, is it your position that, A, they raised some of these objections, or they could have raised these objections, FERC heard them, and FERC either modified or rejected them?
Yes, absolutely, over and over again.
So there's no catch-22 on that?
Certainly not.
But you heard petitioner's counsel say it was impossible to present any evidence at that point because, you know, this was a new experiment. So it was only after you saw how it worked that you could realize that what FERC had in mind in approving the settlement agreement.
Honestly, you know what their evidence was? Oh, my God, the prices went up. And ultimately, that's what it comes down to.
Oh, my God, the prices went up.
Yeah, that's ultimately. And so they infer from that. So therefore, there must have been things going wrong and there must have been market power. And FERC said, no, there are alternative explanations and they're detailed by the market monitor that are perfectly valid.
And just correct me on one point then. When FERC approved the settlement agreement itself,
mm-hmm.
and it said we don't expect these price peaks and that type of thing, what was it referring?
I'm not sure. I think that's being overread. I don't think FERC was making a prediction about the course of prices.
So just so I'm clear here, in my hypothetical,
mm-hmm.
FERC approves a settlement agreement that has a transition provision that results in rates that are unjust and unreasonable. However, this is my hypothetical.
Okay.
The monitor says the tariff was complied with, and there's some explanations. Is it your understanding of FERC's position that essentially that is an insufficient complaint?
No. I think FERC went beyond that, and I think in your hypothetical,
yeah.
you're skipping to it's unjust and unreasonable.
That's purposely, I
think. Right, right. But there has to be a demonstration that it's unjust and unreasonable because that's the burden on a 206 complainant, and FERC said, and you didn't meet it.
And you did not meet it.
Right. And it wasn't simply, as I said, that you just filed the tariff. It was a lot you filed the tariff because a lot of their complaint was, we don't like the tariff. And they said, look, that, to the extent you're just arguing about the tariff, then, you know, we're satisfied. We've already had that debate, and those tariff rules, whether you should get project investment, how steep the demand curve should be, what's the proper measure of an avoidable cost rate. We don't need to go back over that again. It's not worth upsetting these auctions to go back over all that again, which is essentially what they said.
Right. All right.
If there are no more questions, thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the Court. If I may, I'd like to address your questions from briefly a micro perspective on one particular point and then step back because I think FERC did find the price outcomes here were just and reasonable and the rules worked correctly. This is just as things should have been. On the micro question, if you look at petitioner's briefs before this Court, the bell ringer of anomaly that they ring is that, well, first we have suppliers bidding high, and then mysteriously they're bidding low. So something is fishy. Dr. Bowring put his finger precisely on what's wrong with that argument. It assumes, wrongly, that marginal cost, avoidable cost, can never change as we proceed, we march through time. We know that's wrong because opportunities, and hence opportunity costs, can change. But as Dr. Bowring pointed out, the costs which the Commission addressed here, these capital costs, which actually are multi-billion dollar investments to put scrubbers on old coal units in New Jersey and Maryland, to comply with something, for instance, called the Healthy Air Act of Maryland, which requires these things to shut down if you don't put scrubbers on them. Once you install equipment like that, you might choose, and the rules allow this, in a subsequent auction, to view that investment as sunk. As Dr. Bowring pointed out in his affidavit, and I commend his affidavit to you, it very, very precisely gets at this point. This is what Mr. Wilson, elsewhere, has argued is exactly what competitive suppliers would do. And I think if you were to ask Mr. Speck on rebuttal, if he agrees that once a cost is sunk, it should no longer be reflected in bids, he would say yes. That's the macro point. Now, if we step back and go, in particular, Judge Rogers, to your question, well, we have this large amount of money. Rates have gone up. Something surely should be available in terms of remedy here. Let's start with the baseline. Before the RPM market went into place, we had a market design that the Commission found was unjust and unreasonable. It had what, you know, the economists call a vertical demand curve, very, very spiky. It's going to go from 0 to 60 in terms of prices very, very quickly, like that. And prices on average were too low to sustain investment. So we had New Jersey and Maryland and the Eastern Shore plunging into a reliability crisis. They were below the threshold needed to maintain reliability. Enter RPM with a single design criterion that you've seen in the Maine PUC case, you've seen in the Alcon case in New York, and we see here. All of these capacity markets are designed so that, on average, over time, they pay the actual net cost of new entry. I say actual because each of these designs has an estimate, but people don't build with estimated dollars, they build with actual dollars. And I say net because this is supposed to be net of the margins you get from the energy and ancillary services markets. Now, here we have prices that hovered around, went above, and then went below the cost of new entry, which is our long-term benchmark for a just and reasonable rate. And we see that price outcome in circumstances where we're starting in a deficit position. We're starting behind the eight ball, close to the goal line, quite a bit away from the middle of the field. So, of course, you'd expect prices in that instance, in these constrained zones, to be above or near the cost of new entry. We have variance? Yes, we do. Supply and demand conditions were different for each auction that unfolded, as they were for the prior period and the first auction in the rest of pool. If you look at page 17 of our brief, you'll see this. A picture is worth a thousand words, sometimes people say. I commend this to you because it's a chart which is in the record in this case, and it reflects the information the Commission set forth in its orders. In particular, you see unfolding over time many new resources coming to the fore, which, surprise, surprise, change the supply-demand balance. We have demand response coming in in the first auction. We have net exports going down. People are no longer sending power out of PJM to New York, probably. They're keeping it within PJM, actually, more than 1,000 megawatts there. We have net capacity additions. You heard Mr. Speck talk about there could be no new capacity coming in until the final auction. That's not what the Brattle Report says. That's not what the record says. It was coming in the third auction, or the second auction, that he's complaining about, the 08-09 auction. We see withdrawn retirements. People stayed in the market. There were price signals, and they responded. Now, we're told that after the price is set, people take up a binding obligation to provide capacity at a point in the future. everyone in the system, including PJM, is planning based on this resource set being there to support reliability, which actually is what happened. The lights were kept on. We're going to allow petitioners here to come retrade the price if they file before they've paid, because it won't surprise you to learn that much as with haircuts and restaurants and lawyers, electricity products are paid in arrears. Performance under this market begins the moment you clear. Mr. Speck filed his complaint the day before the first delivery period was in effect, but as the commission pointed out throughout the record here in his orders, the obligation sets on immediately, and you have to prepare to provide your product at this future point, starting at that point in time. And at that point in time, you're no longer open for business. Your resource is committed. You have to forego other alternatives. If you reprice that transaction, cutting it by 50% or more, you've left a resource that might have left the system, like perhaps it did before, might have found some other use for its capacity with a higher value. At a point
where, I think FERC's order makes that point about the reliance interests that are at stake here.
Yes.
I do think they addressed that fairly thoroughly.
And embedded within there, Judge Rogers, is one of the keys to this case. Because what the petitioners are trying to do is erase the locational scarcity price signal for New Jersey and Maryland. Dr. Bowring looked at every megawatt in the supply stack and found it was competitively offered under the terms of the tariff, and the tariff is very, very specific on this. And we had a marginal price that was higher than New Jersey and Maryland would prefer to see. What they want to do is strip out that marginal resource from the price formation process and pay it on the side. Well, maybe you can show reliance interest, maybe you need an RMR, but we're just going to take care of you with a side payment, because actually, it's a lot cheaper to do things that way. This is exactly the same tactic that this court affirmed the commission for rejecting in Blumenthal. It was offered and rejected by the commission and this court in the main PUC case. If we can get rid of locational variance and pay on a one-off basis the most expensive resource, of course you will save billions of dollars. But that's not how these markets are designed. And if you were to allow petitioners to retrade the price after the price is set, I would submit to you, you destroy all forward auctions. And you destroy, frankly, all organized markets. They all are based on the fundamental premise we need price certainty, and the Commission has regularly repelled efforts to change the price after it's been set, because there are very, very good design policy reasons for taking that course of action that the Commission sagely and accurately described here. If you let people change the price after everyone has converged toward it and supply and demand have equilibrated, then no one can have faith in the price. No one can know whether to build or not.
Well, you do so if something's gone amiss, right? I mean, you're talking about you don't unsettle prices that have been fairly arrived at, but if there's some suggestion that they haven't been fairly arrived at, then clearly you have the commission has authority and we have authority to unsettle an unfair price, right?
A price that violates the tariff, yes. Unfair is a bit of a value judgment, right? And that is actually the way the petitioners ultimately, you know, offer their case. It's unfair to pay so much. But supply and demand equilibrated here, and this is what it actually costs to keep the lights on. Power is expensive. And if you're going to have a market-based system that sustains investment over time, you have to equilibrate around the cost of new entry. And that's all that's happened here. Sure, it was an abrupt change, that's true, but that was always implicit in the move to this market design. It was always going to be the case.
Don't you agree with the questions Judge Rogers was asking for, that it appears as if FERC itself was surprised by the spike in price? How do you explain that?
I think they were focused mainly on the RTO as a whole, and I think they expected price response, elevated prices in the constrained regions, because they needed resources to come there. Transmission to be built, generation
at this level,
to be built.
At this level? I mean, that's what we're sort of struggling
with. It's the design criterion in the market. Mm-hmm. You know, and I also think it is the case that the market tightened between the time those orders were issued and the auctions occurred here. Mm-hmm. But we need, at that point, the market participants to respond. We need this flood of something like 10,000 megawatts that came into the market in response to these prices before, by the way, this final auction with the full 36-month lead time. We needed that for New Jersey and Maryland, and we got it. Yes, some of these resources in this mix were the marginal unit, and they required higher prices that existed previously to arrive at the scene and keep the lights on. But that's what was needed at the time, and I would submit to you that to come here now and complain about this outcome and try and come up with a way to pay less, it's like, you know, the firemen come, they put out the fire, and then let's see if we can dock their pay. And we think that's retroactive, unfair, and unlawful.
Thank you.
All right, counsel for petitioners.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, let me turn to counsel for FERC's discussion of the capital recovery costs. And I think some of the other, Mr. Flynn and Mr. Estes, also may have mentioned that as well. These were essentially just negotiated adders that were placed on the mitigated levels that the market monitor would enforce. Those were the result of a settlement process. There's no evidentiary record that shows that those were the right adders, and certainly they could have been lower or higher and probably been just and reasonable. The question was whether those particular adders that were placed on the mitigated bids were too generous. And if you look at JA-270, which is Mr. Bowering's affidavit in response to the complaint, particularly at paragraph 15 on that page, he indicates repeatedly that really all he's looking at is the tariff provisions for APIR. He's really not looking beyond that to say those were the right numbers. Our complaint alleged that those were not the right numbers, that despite their efforts, and I think it was all in good faith, everybody was trying to come up with a correct number at that point. They thought it was the correct number. But in fact, what it did was allow the exercise of market power. And that's really the nub of the complaint, is that the system that was set up, particularly during the transition period, permitted the exercise of market power unless you had an adequate mitigation mechanism. And we're just saying that the mitigation mechanism that was applied was inadequate. Now let me look at Mr. Estes' point in his brief at page 17, the chart.
Before we get to that, could sure. I just ask you, my discussion with Mr. Flynn, what would your response be to his point that Mr. Wilson was just taking issue with the terms that FERC had approved?
That's not really the case at all, Your Honor. And if you look at Mr. Wilson's affidavits, both of them, it's almost 200 pages of affidavits, he goes through in great detail looking at the actual implementation of those provisions.
But as I understood Mr. Flynn's point, it was that, for example, Mr. Wilson thought that the environmental costs should not be included.
That's not the case, Your Honor. What Mr. Wilson was saying is just what I was saying. The APIR cost, that capital investment adder, was too high. That's what Mr. Wilson says. He's not saying that they shouldn't be able to recover their legitimately invested costs. And, you know, we're not suggesting, as Mr. Estes said, that the price might not vary from one auction to the next based on sunk costs. What we're saying is that when they, and this is illustrated in 2009 very, very vividly, and this is at JA 140, there's a chart in Mr. Wilson's affidavit.
that shows the differences in the offers from one auction to the next. And in 2009, the offers in the Maryland capacity region just went through the roof. They went all the way up to the absolute cap of 1.5 times CONE, the cost of new entry. And that's what we're arguing is inappropriate and unjust and unreasonable.
But let me just be clear. I mean, 1.5 of CONE was permitted by the tariff.
Yes, of course it was permitted. But it was only permitted under the circumstances where, A, you've got a scarcity, and that would drive it up. There was a scarcity.
Right.
But, B, within the constraints of mitigated offers that would prevent the exercise of market power.
But what do you mean by mitigated offers when we're talking about a capacity-constrained area?
They still had to be mitigated. They still couldn't exercise market power. And particularly, that's true.
Monitor found that they were.
Well, that works perfectly well in the full-term auctions, where you've got the opportunity for new capacity to come in. In the transition period, though, those constrained areas were, in essence, stuck.
Yes.
Nobody else could bring in capacity at that point. All you had were these existing resources. They could bid the price up as high as they wanted. And the only thing that was going to constrain them was the mitigation. And it didn't work in this instance. That's our concern.
Okay.
My time is up, and thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.
Stand, please. We call the court now, send the adjournment to tomorrow morning at 9:30.
I can do it.
That's what I was about to mention.
Let's see. Thank you.